Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're plunging into, well, the currents of global events again today, trying to uncover those surprising connections, the ones that really shape our world, the landscape. It feels like it's shifting beneath our feet faster than ever, and headlines that seem total disconnected. Often they weave together in ways that are, well, much more significant than they first look. Today, we're diving into a stack of your sources that show this fascinating convergence of events. We're looking at declining U.S. global influence, Iran's strategic embrace of a kind of new nationalism, and this really complex dance of regional alliances that ties it all together. Our mission really is to connect these dots, see if we can build a compelling cause and effect chain.
Exactly. And your sources suggest these geopolitical shifts, they're creating this really dynamic environment, an environment that, well, from one specific biblical perspective, focusing on the book of Daniel, could actually align with a prophetic timeline. So we'll unpack that perspective. We'll explore how these, very modern developments might be leading towards a significant regional conflict, specifically between Iran and Turkey. It's a really powerful, maybe unexpected lens to view all this through.
Definitely sounds like we need to connect some serious dots. So join us as we explore these intricate world-shaping connections. Okay, let's start with that foundational shift the sources highlight, this idea of declining U.S. hegemony. You're probably hearing this term more often. But what's really driving this change in global power dynamics? Is it like a deliberate strategy or something deeper, unavoidable?
Well, the sources point to something pretty profound. It seems the U.S.'s spiraling national debt isn't just, a budget issue. It's presented as a structural crack,
Yeah.
right in the foundation of its global power. We're talking about a fiscal reality that's so stark, the sources actually show interest payments on that debt now exceed defense spending for FY 2024.
Wow. Exceeding defense spending.
Yeah. So this isn't just a minor tweak. It looks like a forced strategic retreat, really, from that policeman of the world role America played. The cost of keeping up that unipolar system, where the U.S. was the single dominant superpower, with allies kind of sheltering under its financial and military umbrella, it's just becoming unsustainable.
So it's less a choice and more a fiscal reality check. But what does this huge pressure mean for how the U.S. actually engages with the world? How's its foreign policy changing day to day?
It signals a pretty big transition
Yeah.
from that unipolar dominance to what your sources are calling selective engagement.
Okay, selective engagement. What does that look like on the ground?
Well, first, it means a ruthless prioritization, really focusing foreign policy on core interests, things directly tied to national security, economic prosperity, freedom, the days of being the world's policeman. Well, resource constraints are ending that, according to these analyses.
Fewer interventions, then.
Exactly. A reduced global footprint. Fewer large-scale nation-building projects, less appetite for getting involved in distant conflicts. Third, every single engagement, every alliance, every aid package is going to face a much stricter cost-benefit analysis. Is this really worth it? And linked to that, the U.S. is going to push allies much harder for burden sharing, get them to take more responsibility for their own defense.
Right, take up the slack.
And finally, there's going to be a greater emphasis on non-military tools, diplomacy, trade, cultural exchange, using those more to achieve goals.
Sounds like an unavoidable reckoning, as you said. But is this selective engagement truly a strategic evolution? Or is there a danger it's seen as a retreat, something that creates power vacuums others might rush to fill? Do the sources touch on that risk?
They focus mostly on the inevitability, driven by the fiscal side. They imply the U.S. wants a controlled transition, sure, but the economic pressure is just so intense it has to adapt. The risk of power vacuums, well, it's kind of implicit, isn't it? Especially for regions that have really relied heavily on U.S. support historically.
That has massive implications. Europe, for example, is going to be pushed towards more self-reliance. And parts of Africa, the Middle East, especially areas outside these newly defined core interests, they might see a much smaller U.S. presence.
Which brings us to a really crucial point. How does this U.S. fiscal pressure specifically impact its long-standing alliances and interests in the Middle East, particularly concerning Israel? Your sources highlight something interesting here. The U.S. really needs capital investment to shore up its economy, boost federal revenue. And it seems Saudi Arabia holds a pretty significant key to that puzzle.
Yeah.
How does that financial need play into the U.S. stance on the region?
Right. From the U.S. viewpoint, getting Saudi Arabia and Israel to normalize relations is actually stated as a declared national security interest. A national security interest, why so critical?
Well, because, as your sources point out, it could unlock economic and social integration projects, huge ones. And maybe more importantly, it could free up resources for the U.S. to focus on that great power competition. especially with China. So this makes the U.S. extremely receptive to Saudi investment. It helps their economy and their bigger strategic aims.
Okay, so the U.S. needs the Saudi money, basically, and sees this normalization deal as the path to get it. But what conditions is Saudi Arabia putting on this deal, given their history on the Palestinian issue?
Well, they've been remarkably consistent on this, actually. The sources show they've clearly tied any normalization with Israel to significant progress on Palestinian statehood, a viable path to a two-state solution, and, crucially right now, a ceasefire in Gaza. This creates, well, immense incentive for the U.S. to push Israel for concessions. If Washington wants that Saudi investment and wants to achieve its strategic goals, it needs movement here.
Understood. So this pressure really puts Israel in a tough spot strategically. What could this mean for Israel's military approach, especially with its current government, which includes many religious hardliners?
It could mean, frankly, unprecedented U.S. pressure on Israel. That American need for federal revenue might force policymakers to choose economic pragmatism over, say, ideological alignment with Israel's far-right government elements.
How might that pressure show itself?
It could manifest as public criticism, maybe even conditioning or withholding military support if Israeli actions are seen as jeopardizing these crucial financial deals with Saudi Arabia, or if they undermine broader U.S. goals, like focusing on countering China. It's a very, very high-stakes situation for Israel.
That's a fascinating dilemma. Okay, so how might this increased U.S. pressure affect Israeli governance by these religious hardliners, and maybe Israeli society more broadly?
Well, internally, it would likely create immense friction within the current Israeli coalition. As you said, it includes those far-right nationalist and religious parties. That external pressure could potentially even lead to its collapse. It would certainly erode the hardliners' legitimacy at home.
And for the society itself.
It would probably worsen the already deep divisions there. Some Israelis might see U.S. pressure as undermining their security, definitely. But others, maybe including parts of the military and security establishment, might recognize just how vital that U.S. alliance is existentially. They might push for more pragmatic approaches. It could potentially lead to a more moderate government down the line, but likely only after significant internal turmoil.
A really complex internal dynamic then. Okay, let's shift focus now. Let's turn to Iran. If U.S. support for Israel does shift because of these economic needs and its leverage over an Israeli foreign policy weakens, what's the direct impact on Iran's export commerce?
The primary impact there would likely be a significant reduction, maybe even the eventual lifting, of many U.S. sanctions. A lot of those sanctions are tied, directly or indirectly, to perceived threats against Israeli security.
Right. So if that perception changes or the U.S. priority shifts.
Exactly. If sanctions ease, Iran could re-enter global markets, access international banking properly. This would drastically cut the heavy costs Iran pays to circumvent U.S. sanctions, estimated at over 20% of its gross revenues, according to one source.
20%? That's huge.
It is. They could ramp up oil and gas exports beyond the heavily discounted deals they currently have, mostly with China, their main customer now. They could diversify trade partners. Plus, reduced regional instability generally means safer shipping, maybe more foreign direct investment. So yeah, sanctions relief would be a complete game changer for Iran's economy.
Okay, beyond the pure economics, you mentioned Iran's internal shifts were also significant. What else is contributing to this idea of rising Iranian power?
Absolutely. Your sources talk about Iran's new brand of nationalism. It's interesting. Tehran seems to be actively promoting pre-Islamic Iranian history and figures, like the mythical archer Arash, for example. This looks like a deliberate move to foster unity, national pride, especially after the recent clashes with Israel and the U.S.
A shift from purely revolutionary Islamic identity.
It seems to be a broadening, yes. A departure from past efforts to downplay those pre-Islamic elements. And interestingly, the recent conflict, despite revealing some military and cyber weaknesses, even attacks on nuclear sites, it seems to have inadvertently strengthened national unity, that rally around the flag effect. This shift also suggests that future decisions, maybe even on the nuclear program, might be based more on what Tehran deems best for defending the nation, rather than solely on religious fatwas, those Islamic legal rulings.
Okay, let's connect this to the bigger picture. How does this stronger focus on nationalism affect Iran's relationships, both in the Middle East and maybe globally?
Well, in the Middle East, it could actually increase tensions with some Arab neighbors. Emphasizing Persian nationalism over a purely Islamic one highlights, you know, ethnic and historical differences, Persian versus Arab, Shia versus Sunni. Some might see it as a bid for regional hegemony, prompting other powers to try and counter Iran.
But Iran also has unique strengths, right?
It absolutely does. It holds this unique, powerful position as the center of Shia Islam that gives it significant leverage, soft power, among Shia communities everywhere. And through its network of proxies, Hezbollahs, the Iraqi militias, the Houthis, what's often called the Shia Crescent, that's real influence.
And globally.
Globally, it complicates diplomacy with the West, obviously. But it probably strengthens ties with non-Western powers. Think BRICS nations, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. It plays into that narrative of a multipolar world, resistance to perceived Western dominance. And Iran's strong anti-Western, anti-Israel stance definitely resonates with certain segments around the world.
So Iran's economy looks set to improve if sanctions ease, and its regional influence, its geopolitical leverage, seems to be growing. This raises a really important question. How does all this stack up against Turkey, another major regional power with its own ambitions? What does this mean for potential competition between them?
Yeah, that's a critical comparison. Let's put Iran's evolving nationalism next to Turkey's mix of nationalism and religious ideology. You know, Kemalism, the Turkish Islamic synthesis. What are the similarities, the key differences?
It's intriguing. There are similarities, for sure. Both seem to leverage historical and religious elements to build national unity, especially in crises. Both show very pragmatic state interests driving policy, but the differences are crucial. Turkey's nationalism, especially its foundation in Kemalism, the secular ideology of its founding, aim for a secular nation state, strictly separating religion from public life.
Whereas Iran's nationalism works within the theocracy. Exactly. Iran's current nationalist turn seems like a tool within its theocratic system, not something replacing religious authority. It's using Persian identity to bolster the existing regime. And another key difference, Turkey is a NATO member. Iran's nationalism is much more overtly anti-Western, anti-Israel. Very different postures.
Okay. So Turkey might have an edge in conventional exports, military agriculture, plus its pipeline transit is big revenue. But where could Iran potentially match or even exceed Turkey, especially with these changing dynamics we've discussed?
Iran definitely has unique strengths. Geopolitically, that position as the center of Shia Islam is huge. It gives it leverage and soft power through that Shia Crescent proxy network that Turkey just doesn't have. And its strong anti-Western, anti-Israel narrative gives it a different kind of influence. One Turkey, being in NATO, can't really wield.
What about economically beyond oil?
Well, specific non-oil exports. Petrochemicals are big ethylene polymers, were apparently Iran's top export in 2023. They also have vast mineral resources, the world's largest zinc reserves, second largest copper reserves, plus specialized agriculture, pistachios, dates, saffron. Big potential there. And don't forget human capital. Iran has a highly educated population. If sanctions truly ease, you could see real potential for high-tech exports too.
Okay, let's try and bring this all together. We've painted this really powerful geopolitical picture, a U.S. shifting focus due to financial pressure, Saudi Arabia using its financial leverage, and a resurgent Iran potentially bumping up against Turkey's own regional ambitions. But your sources take this analysis one fascinating step further. How does this real-world dynamic connect back to that prophetic timeline in the Book of Daniel you mentioned earlier?
Right, this is where it gets truly compelling, according to the interpretation in your sources. They indicate that the Book of Daniel, especially chapters 2, 7, 8, and 11, lays out this prophetic framework. And from this specific viewpoint, it's meant to unfold in the end times. It uses these vivid images, metals, powerful beasts representing successive empires, world systems. They appear sequentially, but also kind of exist concurrently, forming a global system. Then chapters 8 through 12 zoom in, focusing specifically on the Holy Land and the rise of a major power, this fourth beast.
And how does our current scenario fit that picture?
Well, the scenario we've just mapped out, Iran gaining regional influence and economic power, while Israel is potentially constrained by U.S. policy shifts, seems, from this perspective, to lay the groundwork for these entities described in Daniel's visions to rise. Crucially, your sources highlight that this culminates in a specific conflict described in Daniel 11, verses 1 to 3, where, I'm quoting the interpretation here, Iran, as modern Persia, stirs up Islam against Turkey as modern Anatolia, which back in Daniel's time was part of the Greek Empire he was describing.
Iran stirring up Islam against Turkey.
Yes. And this event, again, according to this specific interpretation, signals the start of the rising of the fourth beast, which is also referenced, they say, in Revelation 6.1 to 2, which in turn signals the start of the tribulation, that period of intense global upheaval described in biblical prophecy. The warrior king mentioned in Daniel 11.3 is seen as corresponding to the rider on the white horse in Revelation 6.2. And from this viewpoint, all these huge events are supposed to happen within one generation, based on Matthew 24.34, a very specific chain of events that these sources suggest our current geopolitical shifts could actually be setting in motion.
Wow. We've definitely unpacked a really intricate web today, connecting U.S. financial pressure, Saudi leverage, Iran's resurgent nationalism, and that complex rivalry with Turkey. It's a lot to take in.
It really is. And looking at the bigger picture, it just highlights how these global economic and political shifts, even ones that seem totally separate, can converge, and how they can create these profound changes in regional power dynamics.
So what's the takeaway here? I mean, the idea that these modern geopolitical moves might actually be playing out a prophetic timeline leading to a specific conflict between Iran and Turkey, as described in Daniel, that's certainly a powerful thought to consider, isn't it? What stands out to you listening to this? How might these economic pressures on global powers be reshaping the very fabric of regional alliances and potentially setting the stage for future historical events, whether you see that through a purely geopolitical lens or maybe a prophetic one, something to think about.